In the second hour of the afternoon, I will talk about data sources. And given the feedback you had, I'll do it a little bit more frontal, so I tell you a bit more stuff, and I'm happy for you to interrupt if you have questions or if you have things to add. But it's a big agenda we need to get through, so we can't do it quite as interactive as we did the post-lunch summary about the two questions we had. So marketing has become a science, much more than sort of something based on beliefs, because we have orders of magnitude more data. We have new data, we have new communication channels, how we can reach customers and how customers can reach us. So to a large degree, what we are talking about here is exploring what this means for marketing in Web 2.0. And some of the questions I want you to have you in the back of your mind, and by the way, I'm not going to edit the online sheet right now. So if you want to add stuff in the point 4A, then absolutely feel free to do that. Whatever you do now, you don't have to do later. Really, what is it that we can do now that we didn't even think about being able to do beforehand? That's what I want the process to be in the back of your mind. By the way, is this large enough here? Can you pretty much read this? Okay, great. I will put all these notes up afterwards, or actually probably easiest if I put them up and I send them around to everybody. So when you work on putting together your own thoughts, you can just grab anything you want from here. So there are qualitatively new sources of data, and there are quantitative new sources of data. Qualitative new sources are relationship data, which we talked about, allowing social commerce, and sentiment data. Sentiment is trying to aggregate, like buzz metrics, buzz logic does it, trying to aggregate what is the sentiment people have on the web about the stuff which we are talking about. Facebook, of course, MySpace are the examples for relationship data, and the Facebook innovation of using those data to produce new content for you, the Facebook feed, which now gets, of course, replicated by everybody under the sun, including LinkedIn and so on, where it shows you, what your friends, quote unquote, have done, who they have made friends with, et cetera, is, I think, one of the very, very important attributions here, one of the important consequences of having this qualitatively new sources of data. Sentiment, there are a number of companies. One example is OpenMind. OpenMind aggregates across the web. BuzzLogic is another one. And when we talk about the conversation group in the next Sunday, then there will be more examples of what you can do to try to understand what is the sentiment, and then who are the opinion leaders there, how can you influence them, and the answer clearly is not by sending out press releases, but by giving them stuff which they want to use in order to write interesting stories in their blogs about what might be useful for you. Quantitative, I make the following distinction. First, there is transactional data. And transactional means basically what I showed you in my log beforehand. So transaction doesn't mean just point of sales data. And if you think in the olden days that, what did retail really have? Well, maybe they had some notion of how much inventory they have. I learned at lunch today that the Gap only knows for two-thirds, I think that was the number we heard, right? For only two-thirds of their items where they actually are. That's not great for inventory data. Is that what you said, two-thirds? Yeah. Then there could be point of sales data in retail, but point of sales just allows for what's so-called market basket analysis. It knows what stuff gets bought together, but unless you have a loyalty card, and unless you swap your loyalty card routinely with your roommates, then we don't know what your purchasing history is. So besides, people often don't know what to do with those loyalty data. I mean, very difficult to come from data to actions, much easier to start with actions and then do experiments. An experiment's example in retail is in-store displays that you can equip with heat sensors and stuff like this, cameras. These items are all cheap. you can figure out how many people actually are watching the ad I'm showing right now. And then you can see if it's a Coke ad versus a Pepsi ad, how many people are actually buying Coke versus Pepsi in the subsequent 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, whatever it takes in the store. So you can, for those of you who are engineers, there's this notion of impulse response, which characterizes a circuit. So you can give an impulse to the system, show that Coke ad, and then you can measure down the road what is the impulse. Not bad. That's what you can do by doing in-store displays and measuring not only when did you show the display, but also how many people saw it. Even on traditional bulletin boards, they now have cameras which try to measure how many people are walking towards it and might actually potentially be, you know, within the reach, might have seen that message. With Jasmine working on RFIDs here, RFIDs are a very rich example of measuring customer behavior in retail. That, for instance, the example of Metro Group, all the items in that store have RFIDs on them. And as you enter, you have your shopping cart. And there you might be walking by the aisle and, you know, get tempted by that cream cheese. But then you think maybe the low-fat version is better. You put back the full-fat version and you grab the low-fat version. And there you continue. And as you walk by the dieting pills, of course, since you know might want to lose a couple of pounds, that dieting pill suddenly start blinking at you because it might go well with the low-fat cream cheese you just bought. But of course, there's no fixed prices. I'm not making it up. There are no fixed prices in that store. What it has LCD displays, and as you go by, it might say some price, and as you go by, it might say another price. And they're actually very proud of those displays that they don't take any energy unless you change them. So the batteries last for several years in those displays. And of course, it remembers what you saw because it knows where you are. It precisely knows when you were in the angle of opening where you could see the price, so when you check out. But hold it, what does checkout mean? Actually, it knows everything in your cart. So basically what you do is you just wheel your thing through and that's it. Automatically gets deducted from your cart. So if you go to the Metro store, you actually don't have to check out anymore. It knows what you've bought and automatically gets deducted. So now the big question comes. Each RFID, it costs about 2 cents, 5 cents to make one of those guys, and they're about 1 or 2 millimeters, so a good grain of salt. It carries a unique identifier of the item you bought. So it truly is a unique identifier of that item. Not just it was a low-fat cream cheese, but it was that package of the low-fat cream cheese with the expiration date of this and this and the plant it was manufactured at. So, what do I want to do now when I leave the store? Big question. You mentioned the point of privacy before. Should I actually want to get all these RFIDs killed, nuked? Or do I want to keep them? So I can, if I want to return that cream cheese because it's molded, I can actually prove that it was the one I bought at that store as opposed to the competition. Or as opposed to the one I bought 2 months ago and left outside the fridge. Difficult question, unclear whether customers are able to make to that decision. A number of papers have been written about this, and I personally do believe in trying to educate customers, very much so, and showing them again and again what the trade-offs are. But in many cases, people just don't care and they leave these things on. So, okay, let's go on now and I buy this, cream cheese and dieting pills and so forth, put it in the trunk of my car. Now, anybody who is an RFID reader can walk by my car and see what's in the trunk. And luckily, with the cheap stuff I bought, nobody's going to break in. Might be different if you just picked up the Damani suit. In the bigger picture, details here.
Well, it's the technology, right? Your argument is based on the RFID being readable.
But the key thing is that RFID, I agree with you. So hatchback, actually. Let's do hatchback. Or you put it in the back here somewhere. RFIDs, by the way, if you're fast track, the same technology when you drive over the Bay Bridge and you don't have to pay or something like that. That's right. The difference between RFID and actually barcodes is that barcodes you do need to actually have visual contact with it. So if the barcode is at the bottom of the object, then tough luck. But the RFID, as long as you can sort of read it out, which is actually pretty impressive what can be done these days. For instance, my passport has my biometrics. I'm not sure how it's in the United States, but in Europe, passports actually have biometrics in them. So unless you put some device over it, like the equivalence of a trunk, then I can walk by somewhere and, you know, Edmund might be reading out my fingerprint and my retina scan and all of that. And then he can use that down the road to pretend he's me. So very interesting what happened to this data. But long story short, I just want to point out that in retail, we have come a long way from not even, you know, really knowing what I have, 60% at Gap only being accounted for, versus knowing the cream cheese and dieting pill combination. Now, online, of course, you need to know every click, because if you don't know the click, you can't actually serve any product, any detail page to anybody. So what we just saw, maybe as outrageous in the case of the Metro Future store, was the case at Amazon at day one, right? That, you know, whether I looked at that, you know, full-fat cream cheese and then replaced it by the low-fat cream cheese, of course you know that online. That, you know, out of a given choice set, I first looked at that, and then I took it out of my shopping cart and replaced it by something else. So market research in real life is a weak monetization of that. A much stronger monetization of this click data is, of course, people bought X, also bought Y. People bought X, eventually bought Y. All of that stuff, which I briefly talked about in the morning when we talked about recommendations at Amazon.com. Recommendations, we have an hour next Sunday where we talk about not only those recommendations, but also about social recommendations and about situation recommendations. Okay, so much for purchase data as the weakest form and click data as the second weakest form. By the way, Amazon last year collected about 100 terabyte of data. Not only what people click at, but also what you show to them and they didn't click at. So order 100 terabyte costs about, you know, about as much as a garage costs in San Francisco to store all of this data forever. Now things get more interesting. We move from click data to intention data. And why is intention data more interesting?
Sorry, didn't talk about the finance.
Yeah, didn't talk about the finance. So these are my own notes and I don't get through everything. Intention data, I can, you know, turn it off, but I think it might still be useful for you to sort of see my own notes here. So thank you. I'm happy to talk to you in private about it. Intention data, the key thing is that it has a focus on the future. Heidegger, Martin Heidegger, the German philosopher, once said that the future has more impact on the present than the past. And that's an interesting thought. We all think, you know, in our childhood, because when we were in kindergarten, something happened to us, fine. Psychotherapy, I guess, builds its whole reputation on that. But if you think about it, in many ways, and Dan Ariely says that very nicely, that we are basically doing everything we can to prepare ourselves for the future, in the case of his research on hold and cold emotions, stuff like that. So intentions has a future focus. So when I go on, you know, Google or whatever your favorite search engine is, and you put in something, whatever, pizza, Berkeley, then you show in this search that you're interested in something, and that allows for a strong monetization. Namely, Domino's or whatever you have here saying, hey, if you're interested in pizza, Berkeley, we better pay, you know, some money if you click on me at our ad so you actually know where you can find Domino's here. We talked about traceability, we talked about accountability, we talked about transparency. All these things clearly come together here. In the business model which we have called CPC, cost per click, where people only pay for the case when they actually have somebody who clicks at that. Here is and do you have any questions, by the way? Any questions about, you know, as we are going through our journey of data? so far. Do interrupt me. I'm going relatively smooth and relatively fast here, so I don't want to lose people. So here is an example of the so-called performance pyramid. Okay. At the bottom, we have unique users. Unique users come from the day and age of, like, you remember newspapers, where you have a reach, an audience, where you count everybody as one unit, whether they just, you know, touch the newspaper or not even touch it, just throw their eyes on it, or whether they carefully read page for page. Because, you know, why did people do this? Because they could, and that was all they could do. Then you have, after that, something called CPM. CPM, M is a French word for mil, for 1,000, and that means that you pay for 1,000 imprints, a few bucks, paying by impressions. Then you have what I was just referring to here, CPC, which is cost per click. Google being the prime example, its 200 billion market capitalization is based on basically milking the intention economy. You have the intention of finding something, I show you something, you click, you pay. Then you have CPL, cost per lead, which is yet one level up. Of course, you pay much more for a lead than you pay for a click. And then on the very top, you have CPA, or cost per action or per acquisition. This is if that lead actually turns out to become a customer, or, you know, get a mortgage from you or get a credit card from you, then you would really shout out $100. The example I gave you there was Amazon.com's credit card. And so here is, was that a question? Yeah, sorry.
How is cost per lead different from cost per click?
Okay, click means somebody clicked, and that is easily verified information. A lead is that somebody actually maybe filled out a form and says, I'm interested in actually getting a mortgage. And as you fill out the form that you're interested in getting the mortgage, then you are worth more for the advertiser than if you just click on, you know, primary schools, and primary schools happen to be correlated to people relocating and potentially wanting a mortgage. Yes, yes, getting the mortgage. And then you get a kickback of, I don't know, $500, $1,000. So this is the economics here, the standard of intention data. What else did I have here? Then there is some weak monetization, not only the strong monetization, which we talked about here. Key thing being, once again, the feedback loop, that you know, actually, that somebody clicked, as opposed to the previously cited 14 seconds. People are looking at the catalog, and you have no idea what they're looking at. People ask me to give more examples from companies I've been working with. I've been working with, you know, in the spectrum of things, the Finnish Post, Itella. And Finland, as you know, is actually second only in recognition to Nokia. There's more brand recognition in Nokia than in the country of Finland by now. And the Finns, however, are very, very, very advanced when it comes to mobile telephony and stuff like this. So actually, they all have cameras in their digital phones, or phones with the cameras. I'm not sure whether they aren't. And so Itella says, you know, a number of really great innovations. Let me give you two of them. One is, you know, Finland is really spread out. So particularly when it's the winter and it's cold, the nights are very long and the days are very short. You know, those poor mailmen, they want to sort of somewhat minimize the time they have to walk in the dark trying to find those huts. So what Itella says, you can take a picture, a snapshot, of the label of the catalog which we're sending you from whoever we're sending it to you. And you can send a media message, MMS, like a picture to a phone number, with a number between 0 and 9. 0 means forget it. You're just wasting your time and the poor mailman's calories here bringing me this thing on foot probably. No way I'll ever buy whatever it is. 9 means I love it. Send me all you ever have. You know, I just, you know, wait for this every day. So that's how they build in a feedback loop. Sometimes we call it the F word, but I hear that also means something else for feedback marketing. That's one example. The other example which they're doing, which another great innovation is, if you just get yourself an address in Finland, then you can opt in just not getting any mail anymore. Done with mail, no more junk mail. Instead, you get everything and they store it for, I promise, at least whatever, 20 years electronically. So if you're traveling like me a lot, then you know it's just painful to have my mail accumulating at home. So just get an address in Finland and they scan it in every day, they shred it, and you have access to your logger forever, basically. So just a couple of things how you can think about building in feedback in the first case and truly leveraging actually this digital age as opposed to this killing trees kind of age. So the other example is a company called Hitwise. Hitwise, Bill Tanzer, has a lovely blog called ilovedata.com. He's the chief scientist or, you know, whatever his title is, I think general manager of research at Hitwise. And it just has wonderful example from dresses for proms and how things get acyclical. He writes a column for Business Week, not Preacher Tom, that's a different guy. Really an honest column for Business Week, I think once a month. And it's just worth looking into what he has to say about marketing Web 2.0, how many of these consumer trends actually are totally underestimated by traditional companies. ilovedata.com. Trends, you might know Google Trends, and it's always interesting to see what are the trends today. But in interest of time, you know, it takes another 3 minutes, and people are always fascinated to have their own hypotheses. I leave this to you to do in the evening. What's interesting is that by just analyzing search terms across users, you're able to detect things you might not be able to detect otherwise, such as outbreaks of diseases. So, for instance, if in a certain geographic range, which of course Google knows well, because Google knows everything, suddenly people look for, you know, losing their hair, or whatever it is, or losing sleep, or whatever people are losing, then you can suddenly, better than any individual doctor could, who might have two cases, two incidences of that, suddenly say, gee, that's very interesting. So many people here, there must be something going on. And the old pattern, which I believe was maybe 120 years ago, 150 years ago in London, where they traced down, I believe it was cholera, onto a well in London by understanding the geographic location of the deaths. I need to look up the details, but the point was you plot things on a geographic map, and then you knew that well has some problem because people who drink from that well all die or something like that. The same idea of just knowing the searches across the population helps us identify outbreaks of diseases, like, for instance, SARS might have been detected much earlier had we had, you know, people looking at searches than if we just wait until different hospitals sort of randomly sort of say, gee, you know, we had a case like this. Oh, really? I had a case like that too. What's happening there? Okay. Those, ladies and gentlemen, are intention data. So far, what we've talked about. We've talked about what retail knows. We've talked about click data, transaction data, click data, and we've got intention data. We now move from intention data to attention data. So intention is basically, if you think about Google, before I see a page. So here I enter Pizza Berkeley, and there I get shown Domino's Pizza. Now I click at Domino's Pizza. So one distinction, which actually Simply Hired is very good at, is the distinction between short clicks and long clicks. What is this? How long I push the button? No. A short click is basically how many seconds do I stay at that page? Most sequences on the web are Google something, Google something, Google something, Google something. That's how user behavior is on the web. And the high-level bit is, you know, how long is this something? So if it's Google something, then the first something was clearly something we actually read, and, you know, it was something interesting. The second something was, you know, somebody bought some keyword, and they end up, you know, at something which has nothing related to it, so I'm back right away to Google. So the fact that I'm clicking on something doesn't mean that my intention rests on it. The fact that I'm clicking on something means that somebody had a good keyword and somebody had a sexy, you know, tagline there, and that made me text to this. Or Google extracted something which made me click on this. But what really matters is the attention I pay. And one proxy for attention is the time I'm spending on the site. Granted, I might have gone to the bathroom for 5 minutes, or my phone might have rung, or you know, somebody might have, thank you very much, kindly brought me some water, so I might have a sip here. All these things are noisy proxies, but they're better than just ignoring them. Let me ask you, what other attention gestures might there be in this attention economy? What attention gestures could you think of that people are using, which we can use in marketing to understand what they are genuinely interested in? But I'm sorry that I'm not seeing you here. I'm sort of hiding behind this table. What other attention would we have, Deepak?
It could be like how much time you spend on the site. So it's not a content site, but more of a social network or something where you go and do something. Then, you know, how much time you spend overall. It might include a lot of 1 second visits on a particular page, but the overall time on the session time you spend.
Yeah. Time we have talked about, what other attention gestures could you think about? Also think about maybe Facebook, think about relations you might be having, going beyond just time on site. So inviting somebody. Side remark, people are lost. In this world, we actually don't know what's expected. So if you just tell people, you know, hey, push here to invite your friends, I don't know how many friends to invite. It turns out that if you say, invite 20 of your friends, surprise, surprise, people invite 20 of their friends. And so if you set goals in, you know, this case, inviting people, telling people what the expectations are, most people actually comply. So one of the lessons from this class at Stanford in the fall, 10 million in 10 weeks, was that those sites were explicitly stated, invite, say, 20 people, and then, and only then, we will reveal information to you about yourself. Those sites which are much more successful to quickly aggregate lots of people compared to the ones where, you know, it wasn't clear in the first place how many people should I invite, and then the second place it wasn't clear that what do I get if I invite them. Because I don't want my friends to really feel that I'm selling them in order to, you know, get access to some data. What other examples would you have for the question here of what attention data we could have? Yep.
People, the way people navigate the website, like you go to Amazon homepage, you go to cell phones, and you go down to the Nokia. So that the way they navigate tells something about them.
Mm-hmm. So navigation is interesting. Let's push a little further here. For instance, if I annotate something, if I want to remember something, maybe I save it. Google has that feature of actually allowing me to have Google Notes. So I can remember a page. Something which was really a beautiful example of discoverability of a feature was when I used Yahoo Toolbar. That's the way companies collect all your behavior, even if you're neither searching nor on a site they own. If you use Yahoo Toolbar and you just highlight something on the page, it very smartly asks you, hey, do you want to save this to your Yahoo Locker? I didn't even know I had a Yahoo Locker. But really cool that in the moment when you are there and when you're thinking about it, when your attention rests on it, then being asked, so is there something which we can do for you? Would you like to save it? Very powerful. Another example I want to give you is that of tagging. So here so far we talked about clicks. And you can, of course, only click on the links that are on the site. Then we talked about search, that was intention data, where you express intention, but it doesn't depend on the results. And then final, we have something like sometimes called tagging, where you can label an item. So as your attention rests on the item, the amount of specificity you have actually increases. So some people say, you tag, you are what you are tagged as, or you are who you tagged by. Or some people say, you are what you tag. Or some people say, tags are distilled attention. So here's an old screenshot I have from the early days of Delicious. And Delicious is a company which Joshua Schachter started maybe 3-4 years ago and was sold to Yahoo for like $30 million 2 years ago. And what we have here is that a guy called Lawrence Lee lives in San Francisco, that he tags, among other things, housing maps, Craigslist, housing Google, a certain pack, and there are also 446 other people tagging this. He gives it a tag, namely maps. He, of course, is a user. I can see what other stuff does Lawrence Lee do, and I can discover other users who do tag that page. So you see there are lots of possibilities for interactions which Yahoo actually did not understand. I can't just hit up Lawrence Lee and say, hey, dude, I'm always also interested in this. Yahoo doesn't provide that. Facebook understands the importance of relationships. Yahoo didn't at the time. So tagging means that here at a certain point in time, you say you're interested in this. Another example is from Flickr. So here is my friend Quentin, and it says, would you like to comment? So it invites other people to talk about anything about Quentin. Then there are tags, once again, the notion from before, where people who are registered users on Facebook, on Flickr, can add tags to it. And at the heart of it is this picture here in the tagging that you used to live in a world where you have few people who make meaning on top of the pyramid. That pyramid basically has turned upside down. So it's now not only a few anointed people who are allowed to tag photos, Associated Press making decisions, or the Duden Redaktion in Germany, or the Académie Française, but it's basically everybody. Wittgensteinian, meaning equals use. Or if you want to have a Chinese original, which then was translated into English, so far we have come. It used to be in this age of deference, we have leaders, etc., down to the man on the street. And in this new age of reference, we have actually the man on the street who is having the opinion. Wikipedia being an example. Now, what this means for marketing, it is we are focused on where does people's attention live. Okay, so here we are in attention. How do you use this? An example of a company which we might have talked about at the Cisco event is Atenza. So Atenza focuses on the problem of there being so much information in RSS feeds. And gee, when I come in the morning and the 733 feeds I'm subscribing to, 5,000 posts, I don't know where to start. So better, spend the whole day reading feeds, go home in the evening, and repeat, rinse, and so on and so forth. So how do we deal with this? And the notion is that if we look and mine the attention gestures of others within the firewall, may mind the attention gestures of others within the firewall, like within Cisco, then we can actually do a better job of helping other Cisco employees to find the stuff which is relevant for them. So let's say Edmund comes in early in the morning. So he always is in at 6 o'clock, and he plows through his feeds and finds a couple of interesting things. And then somebody else. Anybody else from Cisco here? Oh, wow, so many, okay. Then Venkatesh, he rolls in at 11 o'clock, and, well, why not leverage Edmund's hard work from 6 to 11, that when you came in and you see what did Edmund's attention sit on, and that's what gets highlighted to you. And so it can get highlighted through these attention gestures, like forwarding, relationship data, and essence is that it allows you, MSpoke being another example in this space, to actually get through more information which might be of relevance to you. For marketing, Web 2.0 means it helps you have things bubble up higher which have a chance of being of interest to you to be discovered. All right, so where are we here? We talked about transaction data. We talked about click data, information gathering. We talked about intention data, search data, Google market cap, 200 billion. We talked about attention data, news readers. And now a couple further sources. Relationship data. No surprise anymore after a few hours here that, however, I want to give you a specific example here, which is of a large phone company, early in the alphabet, three letters and a funny character. I can't tell you who it is, but a friend of mine at NYU did some experiments with them. And here is how the experiments worked. And I actually want to take a moment to explain the setup. The phone company, mobile phone company, has a new product. And they have to figure out how to market that product. So they have their mediocrely paid statisticians, reasonably good people, used to be better when they had Bell Labs. And those guys, build really complicated models. Florian knows and the whole stats department here. And they put all these things in the models, and they get a certain lift. And we normalize this to, say, 1. Okay. So 1 means that a certain percentage of people actually buy that product. And then Foster Provo, ex-colleague of mine at NYU, comes along and says, I've heard about this thing called, I think, Web2O or something, and the relationships. And I think phone companies are in the business of knowing who calls whom, right? So that's one of the few things they do well. So they know how to connect people, right? So what about just as a wild thought, marketing to those people who are connected to the people who actually bought the product? Well, it will never work, of course, Well, let's give it a try. So they gave it a try, and it turned out that the lift was 4.8 times the response rate compared to the most advanced direct marketing models. So what we learned from this is that a new data source, a qualitatively new data source, admittedly not necessarily new for phone companies, but new for other things, social marketing, can be way more powerful and, bang for the buck, ROI, whatever you want to call it, have a much higher lift than if you really try to squeeze out with logistic regression and neural networks and genetic programming, anything and everything you can do out of a huge amount of data which you have about past behavior, about where people lived and what their annual income is and what plans they have, subscribed, unsubscribed, where they came from and the service and so on. Last source is location data. Dash is, as I mentioned in the morning, other side of the bay, the first actually bi-directional navigational device. I was very excited when I first heard about it a year and something ago. By now, having thought it through and knowing that, for instance, in Holland, Vodafone already uses mobile phones in traffic. And as I said, April 17th, Microsoft will be launching on the mobile phones, which have, a Microsoft platform, about a similar product, not that excited about Dash anymore. Says, we know where you are and you allow us to access your data. That's where the pack comes in with the customer and not within 5 miles of my newfound best friend. And not more than 100 times a day. It allows us to, of course, know lots and lots of things about me. Mobile marketing, I feel, is a truly two-sided sword. Because one of you said in the morning, Jose, I've forgotten who, your mobile phone is so close to you, with you all the time. Yeah. I have to say, I personally don't see marketing 2.0 entering the mobile space. I'm sorry, if I get my phone to vibrate, I don't want to know that McDonald's now has a voucher for 20 cents off if I walk by and buy 2 burgers in the next half hour. So I think we are underestimating the very personal relationship people have with their mobiles if we think that mobile marketing is one of these web-to-all channels how to reach people.
just saying, well, based on your location, I'm going to give you an ad. But the value of mobile marketing isn't that simplistic. So there's a company, I can't remember who did this, that it's an app that you download to your phone. And when you hear a song or like,
sure,
a bar that you like,
absolutely. Totally. Absolutely, yes. No, that is a beautiful example of push versus pull. So there used to be a company in the late 90s already which allowed you just by knowing the radio station, you dialed in, it knows roughly where you are, you dial in whatever 92.7 or whatever it is at Berkeley, and it looks at the playlist and says, oh, it is whoever it is right now. Absolutely, yes. Different from, however, the typical marketing idea that you try to, you know, reach people with your messages and all that stuff. No, I'm a big fan of discovery, absolutely. There are many examples. For instance, I was at Sony Ericsson, and they showed me a very impressive demo. I mean, it's about the only impressive thing I've seen at Sony Ericsson, which was that you can take a picture of an object, and it will tell you, actually, where you can buy it. The only thing is I had to tell them that there's a company called like.com in the Bay Area where you can, you know, do this and could have done it already a year ago. Who knows like.com, by the way? It's another good example, maybe I show it for a second here, of how you can take a picture of some item. So maybe I like your glasses. So I take a picture of your glasses and I upload it to like.com. And then it will show me where these glasses are. So here's another example, you know, for watches or for, you know, shoes. And let's see, maybe sneakers. So if I do visual search here, so there's this Adidas sneaker. And you can then say, hey, oh, this item is no longer available from Zappos. That really sucks. Zappos is actually an amazing company. So let's see, what about this one here? Okay, now I can draw a box on the item to focus on search in that area. Let me make it a little bit bigger here. Although it's dangerous, then it might not get the area right. So if I now draw here and I draw it on, you know, guess what? How about the three stripes? You know, that was a little small, actually. It's too fresh. If I draw here that area of the three stripes, and now it's looking for shoes which have three stripes on them. I can filter by price. Please wait while your request is processed. And here we are. And what you see is, funny enough, it really shows shoes with stripes now. But not necessarily three stripes. It also does shoes with two stripes and one stripes. So it's always a question what at the example is an example. And this Donald J. Plinamasso doesn't really resemble, you know, to me in sort of the Adidas shoe we had up there, but it has a stripe, or it has something which looks like a stripe. So you can do visual shopping, so you can take pictures of glasses, belts, you know, underwear, whatever, and then you can go to Zappos and say, show me more like this. There's lightning, candelabras, it's a big world there. And what's the business model? What do you think, actually? What do you think the business model is? Be more specific, please. Yeah, I think sort of. It is really that now. If there are pictures, you know, on my Flickr stream, for instance, about people wearing Adidas sneakers, it then says, hey, you want to buy those sneakers? Click here. So it's a mix of all of the above, plus when there are pictures that you can show via like.com ads, say, for shoes and Zappos, which correspond to the items in the picture. It's another example of a company, very smart people, who actually did something totally different at first. They did face recognition. And they thought it would be a great business to actually sell face recognition software to, you know, people in the Washington area. But then, you know, they found that, you know, retail also, you know, pays the bills. Okay. location data, mobile marketing, mobile phones, phone always with you. What you want to do is you want to use a data collection. A big business is that you try to find out what prices are at different spots so you can incentivize people. But hey, you want to know which price you pay for that item somewhere else? Just snag a picture of the barcode and we will tell you where you could buy it online or where you could buy it in the vicinity if you tell us how much it is in the store. So it's sort of quid pro quo, give data, unclear who pays whom, mixed model of having all the ingredients we talked about so far. That was a quick survey of data sources, which are pretty much changing the way, I think, what marketers used to know to what marketers know now. I mean, if you really think back like 10 years ago, gee, I mean, poor marketers, I mean, they knew so little about people, just amazing. But they had so little outlets. They could just, you know, show something on Super Bowl. Versus now, how much we know about the individual, long way we have come, long way to go. The question of privacy, which is one of the topics for the second day, of course, is lurking behind everything I've been saying here. My view is that, you know, customers are smart. We have to show them the trade-offs. And then, you know, if we screw them, actually, it will come up very quickly, as some of the examples we had earlier showed us. Any questions about the data sources for marketing and web tool? If not, it's the Sunday afternoon, low, I know. Let's do another 10-minute plus epsilon break and meet here at 4:05, where we are talking not about the data sources, but about the economics of data. And then at 5:00, Florian is going to join us. Let's be generous. Let's say 4:10, so we have 15 minutes. Quick question. Does anybody know where there's any coffee machine or any way to get coffee here?
Strada.
In that case, I need some coffee here, you know, I just came back. Why don't we then say we really start on time at 4:15? So we have actually time to run to Strada and get some coffee there. Or do you feel cheated if we take such a long break?
No?
Okay, 4:15, freshly caffeinated, back here.